Greetings. Hope you're all doing well today. You are listening to Mental Health Matters on the Jefferson Exchange with Jefferson Public Radio and NAMI Southern Oregon. I'm Andra Hollenbeck with NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Southern Oregon. And when we talk about health, we cannot discuss health without including our complete mental health. So on this program, we highlight mental health issues in our community and ways we can improve mental health for everyone. Today, we're talking about PTSD and anxiety disorders with Dr. Robert Kyler. Dr. Kyler is a practicing clinical psychologist in Houston, Texas currently, and an authority on PTSD and panic disorders. Welcome, Dr. Kyler. Good morning.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us on the program. So, Dr. Kyler, you have quite a bit of clinical experience that I saw. Would you tell us a bit about your background, sort of your current position, and how it was that you came to be an expert and advocate for mental health?
Yeah, so I've been a clinical psychologist for decades now and got interested very early on in access problems in mental health, which led to a variety of different paths in my career, including developing mental health resources in rural hospitals around the Southwest. Along the way, I started getting involved in psychiatric telemedicine because it was extremely hard to find qualified personnel, particularly the psychiatrist, to be able to, you know, be in person in remote locations in the Southwest, rural Texas and New Mexico in particular. And with that interest in technology and mental health, I was introduced to the company that I now work with, which is called Freespira. I serve as the chief clinical officer of that company, and it uses a methodology, basically a hardware and software system for helping people with panic symptoms and then subsequently with PTSD, how to learn healthy breathing via feedback of their breathing style. This has been available now for about 10 years, and so I supervise our clinical teams, deeply involved in our research efforts, very exciting to be part of a movement really for broadening access to mental health care, in part by using technological channels.
Oh, okay. We often hear about PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder in relationship to veterans of wars, but it seems much more widespread than this. So what is the prevalence of PTSD?
Yeah, great question. I think for a long time, most of the public have thought about PTSD as a military or a combat phenomenon.
Yeah.
And actually, the rates of lifetime incidents are really pretty close for civilians and veterans. Lifetime, about 6 to 7%. Presence of symptoms in the past year, about 3.5%. When we look at veterans who have served during armed conflict like Iraq, Afghanistan, rates of PTSD are more like 20 to 30%. But you know, when you look at it in that general perspective, there are really about 10 times more civilians than veterans in this country who are experiencing the really life-altering impact of post-traumatic stress.
Right. So a veteran might have, they're more likely to have it, but it's still something that's pretty pervasive throughout. So what causes PTSD, and then what would that look like? What would people be experiencing? So I'm kind of interested in the cause, and then what does that look like?
Well, it's a great question. Really, the definition of PTSD centers around exposure to one or multiple dramatic traumatic events. Typically, we look at threat to life or expectation that one may be, die or be injured. So there's what we call an index trauma. And the other thing that I ought to mention here is that exposure to trauma does not equal PTSD. About 25% of people exposed to significant trauma go on to develop PTSD, which makes this complicated because about 75% of people who were exposed to significant trauma, it does not consolidate into what we call PTSD. So there are a variety of things. It's really a source of active study. We believe that there are genetic components, exposure to trauma and adversity earlier in life increases the risk of PTSD, so that you may have a more recent trauma, for example, exposure to crime, sexual assault, motor vehicle accident, but it's layered on top of someone who has grown up right. in an environment in which loss, trauma, dislocation, et cetera, were features of their earlier life.
It could be a cumulative sort of effect that there's several little
Absolutely.
Traumas and then a big one that kind of really triggers some symptoms. So how does someone know what's kind of a normal trauma response and then what makes
yeah.
it become a disorder?
Sure. I think one thing that we can say is that exposure to trauma is stressful and disturbing. What we see is that for the lucky people who don't develop PTSD, those effects settle down, you know, in the neighborhood of 6 to 9 months or a year post-trauma.
Okay.
And it's not that people will forget about or not be affected by that trauma, but it doesn't consolidate into what we call PTSD. So I'll really kind of talk about what are looked at as the four main categories of experiences that really characterize PTSD. One is that we call re-experiencing.
Okay.
And that can come back in a variety of different forms. Nightmares of the traumatic event are very, very common. Feeling like you're reliving the event. Exposure to reminders of that trauma. It could be a scene in a movie. I often, to make it kind of tangible, think about the veteran from Iraq who drives past an overturned garbage can who immediately says, my God, that's mm-hmm. where the bomb would be,
mm-hmm.
So that you have that reminder. And what's really compelling is the individual is experiencing the reminder as though it were happening again. It's kind of like time disappears.
Mm-hmm. And they're back in that moment.
Back in the moment and with intensity
mm-hmm.
that is just absolutely compelling. It can be sights, it can be sounds, it can be smells. There are a whole variety of these associations to that traumatic event that then trigger what we call this experiencing.
Right.
Now, the next thing kind of goes along pretty logically, and that is avoiding circumstances that remind you of the event. So if you can imagine, that kind of triggering
yeah.
event, people who suffer from PTSD develop a variety of different what we call avoidance
mm-hmm.
symptoms or avoidance maneuvers. So that may be avoiding crowds. It may be not driving if you were in a car accident, avoiding, movies, media, whatever that could have content that would potentially remind one of the trauma. It also is shutting down. You don't want to think or talk about the event. So there's kind of we'll lead into the next part and that negative thoughts and feelings. The next part is numbing out. And so what some people really talk about is they really can't experience the positive or joyful experiences that they ordinarily would have or used to have. And that numbing out,
mm-hmm.
we think, is a way that the mind kind of psychologically shuts down to screen out
yeah.
reminders of the trauma. Forgetting traumatic events, not being able to talk about them, feeling like the world is dangerous and people can't be trusted,
mm-hmm.
feeling for some people intense guilt or shame if they feel like there was something they could or should have done to prevent it.
Right. Okay. Great.
Then the next part is what we call hyperarousal. And that is, I talked about scanning the world for danger. And so this hyperarousal manifests itself in a number of different ways. Startle responses, people who are scanning the environment for threat, having a hard time sleeping. It takes a certain amount of trust in the world to shut your eyes and become unconscious, right?
Right.
I'll just add another, and that is that part of numbing is about 20% of people with PTSD have a substance use problem.
Okay.
And many times it was not there before the traumatic event, but for some people, they drink themselves to sleep,
mm-hmm.
use cannabis to put themselves to sleep, mm-hmm. to take the edge off,
right.
And we know that substances are really not an effective way of managing those symptoms, and then they can grow into a whole other set of problems.
Yeah, like a lot of other mental health symptoms, people want to try to treat themselves with their,
yeah,
self-medicating behaviors. Well, you are listening to Mental Health Matters on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Andra Hollenbeck of NAMI Southern Oregon, and we're speaking with Dr. Kyler on post-traumatic stress and anxiety disorder. So that was a really comprehensive explanation of kind of the experience of PTSD. So let's talk about the treatments. I imagine that I think there's many different kinds of treatments for PTSD. Mm-hmm. I imagine some of them are medical, some of them are probably therapeutic. What are some of the treatments, and how does technology play a role in some of these new treatments?
I could talk for a long time about this, but unfortunately and paradoxically, the best research treatments are hard to tolerate. So the best research therapies, talk therapies, require gradually reliving your traumatic memories. It's called prolonged exposure therapy, or its cousins. And for people who can tolerate it, it's highly effective. The challenge is there are lots of people who cannot engage in a therapy that requires them even gradually to re-experiencing their traumatic memory. So in even, you know, very good research, you see this really divide. The people who can tolerate and complete the treatment have great outcomes. And in some studies, of multiple studies, almost 50% of people drop out of these before they get a full dose of the therapy. And then the other approved medications for PTSD are antidepressants. There are a couple of antidepressants that have been studied, and they are highly effective for the group of people who will take them, but they have side effect burdens, and there are a lot of people who discontinue because the side effects are not particularly, they're not tolerable. Our company has an intervention that's approved by the FDA. We call it FDA clearance initially for panic attacks and panic disorder, and then PTSD, that addresses dysfunctional breathing. So that's an example of a technological approach. We have essentially a medical device that measures your respiratory physiology. We give people kind of precise feedback of their breathing. And we had terrific results with panic, and we were not certain whether it would extend to PTSD, although there's a lot of overlap. The majority of people with PTSD have panic symptoms that are triggered by their traumatic reminders. And some research that was done at the Palo Alto VA showed very, very strong response rates for people with chronic PTSD. About 70% of the people who were in this study, had clinically significant benefit. The other thing that was really interesting is that the dropout rate was very low. It was about 10% compared to about 50% in the other studies that I was talking about.
So it sounds like it was more easily implemented for the clients as well, for people with PTSD.
Well, it's done at home, which is an access issue and also kind of a comfortable, a comfort issue and a privacy issue. This has to be prescribed by a healthcare professional. So again, it's not an app store thing. But the other thing about it is that we are teaching people a self-control method, but also kind of fine-tuning their physiology that kind of settles down the body's reactivity and settles down the panic component of PTSD. And what we find is that people begin to experiment with the life that they gave up after they became very avoidant. One of the most moving stories I heard from one of our coaches, she was wrapping up with a combat veteran who told her, I took my 5-year-old daughter to the movies for the first time in her life. And you can just hear that sentence and say, my God, this is one of our intensively trained soldiers who could not be in a dark room with strangers and now can. So it's an example of what we hear often of people once they develop a sense of mastery, of self-control, really about the kind of bodily manifestations of panic, and develop skills that they can use out in the world, they start to kind of re-engage in parts of life that they were giving up.
Well, it is great that there are these other options now for folks, and the more options we can give people, the better overall results we'll have. So I really thank you for sharing that with us this morning. This is Andra Hollenbeck, and you can find out more about NAMI Southern Oregon at our website, namisouthernoregon.org, or you can email us at info@namisouthernoregon.org. This is Mental Health Matters, and thank you again for joining us, and thank you, Dr. Kyler, for being with us. You can find this and other interviews at thejeffexchange.org, or you can subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.